south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan. This is episode 265, covering the week of June 7th through June 11th, 2021. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all those social media accounts at our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E, institute.org. While you're there, give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition by 20 Abbeville Institute Scholars. It's a great book, free of charge, just for giving us an email address. And of course, you get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday, or 5 days a week. Sometimes it's Monday through Saturday, or Tuesday through Saturday. It depends. Sometimes you get one on Sunday, but you're going to get our daily dose of Dixie 5 days a week. You can also, while you're there, click on that support tab. You can give us a donation. We exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like the podcast, you like the website, you like everything we do, consider a tax-deductible donation to the Institute. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. You can set it up however you want. We have endowment and plan giving. If you've got stocks or other things you'd like to give us to keep this going, what is the Southern Tradition worth to you? Is it worth $5 a month or $10 a month? These articles that we do and all the stuff we do is not free of charge. It costs money to keep all these things going. It costs money in personnel. It costs money in expenses on the back end. It costs money to do all of these things. So if these things are important to you, if exploring the Southern Tradition, if putting out there a positive vision of the South and Southern history and the Southern Tradition, an accurate vision of that is important to you, then consider a donation. Because we do appreciate every penny you can throw our way. We have a lot of people, well, I don't have a lot of money. Great. I mean, we understand that. Not great that you don't have a lot of money, but we understand that you may not have a lot of money. If you sent us $2, we'd appreciate the $2 you sent us. If that's all you can send, we're not going to be picky about it. And we'll say thank you very much. And we appreciate everything you do. You look at these monuments that were built, we talk a lot about. They were built with pennies, people sending pennies. Thousands of people sending pennies. If everyone on our email list, if everyone listened to this show, if everyone that read our articles would just send us $5, we'd have enough to operate for a few years if we just did that. So it's important to note that even that $5 or $5 a month in particular, if we had everyone send us $5 a month, it would be remarkable for what we could do in the Institute. So keep that in mind when you're thinking about, you know, your monthly expenses. If you drink an expensive cup of coffee, it's $5. Could you spend that $5 for us and forego one cup of coffee a month or something like that? We do appreciate everything you do, though. So if you do give us a little bit of money, we appreciate it. If you give us a lot of money, we appreciate it. It's either way, it's both appreciated the same. All right. So you can also click on that shop tab, get your Abbeville Institute apparel. I mean, it's great stuff. You know, so there's all kinds of ways. And of course, share the podcast around on social media, rate it where you get your podcasts. Let people know you're listening to this podcast and let people know you're interested in the Southern Tradition. All right, so let's talk about the material for the week. A lot of great stuff this week. If you listen to my own personal podcast, the Brian McClanahan Show, I was hard on Lincoln all week, the Lincolnian myth. And we've got a little bit of that here too. It's one of the most important things to understand about what we're facing today. You see, we've got the left, which is fully invested in the Lincolnian myth of America. The one-size-fits-all nationalist myth. They want the progressives want to control the center, and they want to control everything top-down, and they believe in the proposition nation. It's just that people betrayed it, particularly the South. The South has always been the evil other of American society. They need to be done away with. The Southern Tradition is the wrench in the system. It is the speed bump to forwarding this progressive agenda and foisting it on America. We just didn't have John C. Calhoun. If we didn't have all these evil Southerners down there, if we didn't have that war, I mean, the Southerners, you know, fighting, we didn't have that, we would have had a great utopia. It's just that if we would have had New England winning. Now, of course, we're looking at what New England looks like when New England wins, because New England has won. That's modern America. So you've got the right doing the exact same thing. The neoconservatives, the Claremont people, the Straussians, they all do the same thing. And that is that America is a proposition nation. And so because of that, we can do this one-size-fits-all stuff. And, you know, the Americas, we had these bad people out there, the Southerners primarily. I mean, Russell Kirk writing about the Southern Tradition, and we included John Randolph of Roanoke, who just had a birthday, by the way, last week. We didn't talk about it, but The day before Jefferson Davis's birthday, June 2nd, is John Randolph of Roanoke's birthday. Big day, Jefferson Davis, June 3rd. But a lot of big birthdays. Clyde Wilson's birthday, by the way, is this week. So that's a great thing. Clyde Wilson at the Abbey Village, one of our most important individuals in the history of the Institute. So his birthday is this week. A lot of great, important people born in June. And so we had John Randolph, but we didn't have Russell Kirk writing about John Randolph and John C. Calhoun. You see, they're bad. And, you know, Harry Jaffa wrote a piece for National Review right after William Buckley died. And I was sent this by, I forgot about this piece. I had read it and I forgot about it. Paul Gottfried sent me a link to it. Here you go. Here's Jaffa writing about, you know, his influence. And he admitted, he said, look, before I wrote that Lincoln was a conservative, nobody thought that Lincoln was a conservative. Gee, I wonder why. Because he wasn't. He never was. Lincoln never was a conservative, yet we have this impression that Lincoln somehow is conservative now. And you get that from the radicals in the Congress who said Lincoln wasn't a conservative. He was too conservative for them. He wasn't radical enough. After he dies, though, they're the ones that make him a martyr because they realize that by taking Lincoln and making him a martyr, they could run with their agenda and they could say Lincoln would have supported this. And so therefore, it's all Lincolnian. That's what the modern Republican Party, they want the radical Republicans to be their guys because that deflects, they think, any charges of racism or pro-slavery, any of that stuff. Because if you say good things about Calhoun, well, then you're just a racist pro-slavery advocate, even when you're not. But because Calhoun said some very important things about American society, if you say anything about positive about Calhoun, oh my gosh, you just said the most awful thing. You have just praised the American Hitler to the left and the neoconservatives. This is what they think. When there's no comparison at all between Hitler and Calhoun. None. And, of course, unfortunately, we have people that run around in the South and they try to make comparisons between the Nazis and somehow the Southern tradition, and they're a bunch of morons for doing it. But this is what we have, right? So we've got these problems. So our job at the Abbeville Institute is to promote the Southern tradition, the real Southern tradition, and not what the idiots who run with it in a different direction like to do. And then, of course, not what the left says about it either. We try to show you the true Southern tradition and valuable Southern tradition, what that means for America. I wouldn't do this podcast every week. I wouldn't take part in the Institute. I wouldn't be so involved in it if I didn't think that it was beneficial for America moving forward to think about the Southern tradition and what that means for America in the future. Whether it's the environment, let's think about, you know, agrarianism and the environment, how important the South was in that. Or whether it's Christian charity, or whether it's political decentralization, the arts, music, art, literature. There is so much that's valuable about the South that we need to talk about. And I've said, you know, the first part of America, the South was America. The South is America. I used to say that a lot on this podcast. The South is America. But what we conceptualize of America as America, at least up to 1860, that was the South. And then, of course, after that, then we get this very Lincolnian. But as Bradley T. Johnson pointed out, I think it was Bradley T. Johnson pointed out, the Lincoln was Southern, I mean, in many ways, born in Kentucky. So, you know, you wouldn't have even the Union win the war, the United States win the war, without Southerners doing that as well. So the great military heroes of America, at least early America, most of them were Southern. Of course, afterwards, you've got a lot of great heroes. We just had, and we're going to talk about that, you had a lot of great heroes around the United States, people doing heroic things, not from the South. But that's part of that Lincolnian nationalism. So let's start actually with this first piece of the week. It's by Avery L. Kessler, and she writes great stuff for us, you know, usually poems or literature, short stories primarily, I should say. But she wrote this little piece about a remembrance, and there's one line in it that I thought was so good. Of course, June 6th, we had the D-Day, anniversary of D-Day, Operation Overlord. And, you know, so there's that. And, Boyd Cathy, and I meant to do this, we meant to put it up, and I reversed the pieces, but we had a Boyd Cathy piece this week on something else. But when you look at the influence of World War II on America and what that means for America and the Lincolnian tradition, We'll have something on that later. But I wanted to focus on this because World War II was such an important event in American history. I mean, you can't get around it. And the title of this piece is Fighting for 5 Miles. And so Mrs. Kessler went to France at one point looking for a relative of hers with her family. His name was Charles Willis Kessler. He was killed on June 14th in France, June 14th, 1944. He survived D-Day. And I think that, you know, 9 days later he's killed. You think about the tragedy of all of that. Survived the initial assault. He didn't take part in, I don't know if he did or not, but you survived that first day and you're at D-Day plus 9, which is what they used to call it, and you get killed there. And how many Americans saw that? They make it through that first part, and then they get the next day and the next day, and then it's the tragedy of all of that. It's hard to comprehend. And how this war affected everywhere. And Charles Willis Kessler was from Louisiana. He graduated from LSU. So they go to France to try to find his grave. And I love this part of the piece. She says, so why did Willis go to war? He went by Willis. What caused this young man fresh out of LSU to leave his home and volunteer to fight for his country? A few facts are clear. Pearl Harbor, Hitler's ruthless invasion of Europe, the sinking of American ships as well as those of our allies, U-boats invading the North Atlantic with the intent of blockading all ships, the creeping realization that angry tyrants sought to take over the world. But I think his motivations were more than that. In fact, she doesn't say this, but they were pretty simple. Hot bowls of oatmeal. His mother served her large family on cold winter mornings, as well as her homemade donuts. Watching his father walk to his job, managing a sawmill. It was a job he chose to do, not one forced upon him. It was Willis's small-town sensibilities, dedicated teachers, and Sunday meetings at Eunice's Baptist Church, as well as a broadening of views when he entered college. Again, his choice, his future, his chance to shine. I love this next paragraph. He did not fight to affirm someone else's desire to control the free expression of ideas, parse speech, stamp out unacceptable words, or advance the views of the easily offended who only offer their own brand of tyranny. That would have been unthinkable to his day. He did not give his life to encourage mob violence, censorship, or cutthroat politics. Again, unthinkable, even though memories of the kingfish still echoed in Louisiana. He fought for the ideals he had been raised on in the fear that his way of life would be taken away forever. Although his way of life may not have been more than a 5-mile radius around home, it was his and was worth fighting for to preserve and secure the blessings of liberty for himself and his family. He fought for 5 miles. When he left and he faced a sniper's bullet that ended his life in Germany, in France, a German sniper's bullet in France, he was fighting for 5 miles, 5 miles around his hometown. He was fighting for those bowls of oatmeal and that church and those donuts. And he was fighting for that school that he went to. And you see, for us who fight for the Southern tradition on a regular basis, that's what we're fighting for. The people around you. The people that you don't want to denounce and call horrible names because that's your blood. Those are the people that you can call them what you want, but you don't want somebody else calling them that. And that's it. That's what you're fighting for. And for many Southerners who went off to war in 1861, it was the same thing. They're fighting for that home, and they said it. Well, if the Yankees would stop fighting us and go home, we'd stop fighting them. Isn't that what we want? That's what they were fighting for. This is why the peace on Friday, secession was not about slavery, is so important, because really when you look at it, it's a local thing. Secession was not about slavery. You can, how can you say that? I got the document right here, it says it. Well, not true. Most people were fighting because there was an opposition to an understanding of a constitution that had been ratified 80 years before, and that was being consistently violated by the North. That's what it was fighting for. And of course, we know that Southerners were willing to end slavery to maintain their independence. That was an important part of it that's often lost. And this piece on Friday gets into that. The efforts Southerners were willing to go through to end the institution to keep their independence. Not, they weren't saying, you know what, if you, we have to get rid of slavery, we're just, that's it. No, no. They were willing to do it because all they really wanted was that independence. They thought that was worth preserving. Same thing with Willis Kessler going off to fight. And he was just fighting for that 5 miles. For many Southerners who went off to fight in 61, they were fighting for the 5 miles around their house. They were fighting for the few hundred acres that they had and that they wanted to keep out, the Yankees out. That was it. They wanted to fight for their own political self-determination. That was all. Some fought for other things. We know that. Some Northerners fought against slavery. Some Southerners fought for slavery. Many Southerners fought against slavery, and it was their own enslavement in their own mind. This is what, not what Brian McClanahan said, but it's what James McPherson said in For Cause and Comrades. This is what Gary Gallagher said in the Confederate War. We know Northerners were fighting for money because they were getting paid to be in the army. Lincoln's mercenaries. We know that's the case. William Marvel wrote a great book, Lincoln's Mercenaries. Go out and read that. It's fantastic. Short little book, but it's fantastic. So we know this was the case. So these Southerners who were, most of them volunteer. I mean, we know there was a draft. We know that people were drafted in, but they weren't doing it for the money, certainly. They were fighting for 5 miles, just as Willis Kessler, who joined the military, volunteered to be in the military, volunteered to go face the line of fire, and then ultimately died because of it, was doing the same thing. So what's really at stake? What are we fighting for now? What is the Abbeville Institute fighting for? Well, it's fighting for stories, fighting for Willis Kessler. It's fighting for the people that went off and fought and died in 61. It's fighting to preserve Western civilization. And you have a couple of really good pieces this week on that. The first is by Valerie Protopapas, Western Civilization Postscriptum, and how what's really at stake is Western civilization. And, of course, the South held on to Western civilization, I think, harder and longer than any other section in America in the maintenance of Western civilization. This is why Lord Acton could run around and say, you know, the South, by the South losing, we've seen the end of real civilization in America. It's why H.L. Mencken could point out that he admired the Old South because that was real civilization. He didn't like the part of the South that's, he would call, you know, the uneducated part of the South. He didn't like the white, what he would call white trash or the trashy part of the South. He didn't like that. But he certainly liked the aristocratic South. And he thought that was good for America. That aristocratic South was good for America. And that's what we lost with the steamrolling of Lincolnian America. And it's Western civilization that's being destroyed. And as Ms. Protopapas points out, this is Orwellian, what's happening. There's now technology to do exactly what George Orwell prophesized about in 1984, where different things go down the memory hole. Nice example of that, the Washington Post, after 15 months, over a year, went back and edited a headline online to say something different because they knew that the old headline was wrong. So what do? They changed the story. Now, because of technology, they can do that. Used to be you couldn't do that. Once it's in print, you can't change it. But they can do it now online. You can change stuff. You don't have to issue retractions, you just change it. Oh, what? I don't see that old headline. Of course, people catch these things. People go out and they do this all the time. They look for newspapers to do these kind of changes because that is Orwellian. And she's saying this is what can happen. You can just change the language. You can change the headlines. You can change everything with technology. I didn't really say that. I didn't say that at all. Well, you've got the evidence. Now, of course, with artificial intelligence and other things, we have to be careful about what people actually did say and what they didn't say. That's dangerous. So we have this push to change Western civilization. And part of that, of course, is only possible because of the Lincolnian myth of American history. And that's where you get to Boyd Cathy's piece on Wednesday. And I'm going to read most of this because this really gets to it. He says, the Federalist Online magazine has a problem. It's a condition that characterizes and infects almost the entirety of the present national conservative media. This hit home for me on May 31st in an essay by Leslie McAdoo Gordon. Founded in 2013 by Ben Dominic, thefederalist.com is not connected to the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies, which is composed of conservatives and libertarians dedicated to reforming the current legal order. I read the Federalist.com website, webzine, almost every day, and occasionally it is the source for items of value and good information. But Gordon's ill-informed attack on Confederate iconography was not one of them. Peddled as a defense of retaining Antietam as the name of an American naval vessel, she begins her piece, quote, there is a move these days to revisit our monuments and the names we chose or choose to publicly honor. This movement is good and just. It is a sign of our mature democracy that we can choose to stop honoring things that do not reflect our American ideals and celebrate those that do, including rejecting anything related to the Confederacy. Honoring and celebrating the history of, and symbols of the Old South, once a common occurrence in the pages of the Conservative Quarterly, Modern Age, or a National Review, are now illegal, beyond the pale. General Robert E. Lee, praised by President Eisenhower in 1960, is one of the supremely gifted men produced by our nation. Noble as a leader and as a man, and unsullied as I read the pages of our history, is now exiled from the conservative pantheon, as is anything immemorializing or commemorating Confederate heroes and iconography. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Colonel John, the Gray Ghost, Mosby, General Nathan Bedford Forrest are now canceled, their monuments ingloriously pulled down and their exploits stricken from textbooks, or worse, treated like depredations of Nazi fanatics. This is true. It's a Lincolnian myth. You see, Gordon is a byproduct. Now, I could do something like on this every single day. I could talk about this on my own podcast every single day. I just did a whole week, essentially, on this. But this is the real problem. We have conservatives rushing, just like the left, to tear these things down because these people were traitors. These people had views that we find repugnant. They can't be there. Well, so did George Washington. So did Thomas Jefferson, but yet we leave them up. This is where Trump was actually more effective when the reporter asked him about it. He said, hey, you like Thomas Jefferson? You like George Washington? I like them too. Shut up, basically. No, shut up. In fact, the response to all this, and I did this on my own show, no, shut up. It should be the response to anyone who wants to take down any statue of any American that was honored in any part in the United States. No, shut up. We're not taking it down. You want to add your own monuments, your own statues, okay. But we're not taking these down because that's destructive, and there's no reason for it. Like most established conservative media organizations, the Federalist.com appears to be part of what Paul Gottfried calls Con Inc. That is, the stagnated national conservative bureaucracy centered in Washington, D.C., dominated by neoconservatives, and more concerned about not rocking the boat too much so as to not be attacked by the frenzied left as racist or protecting white supremacy, or perhaps being taken off the A-list of invitees to posh D.C. social events and soirees. Perhaps the worst thing is to be a traditional or a paleoconservative type, most especially a representative of the Southern tradition, like the late Mel Bradford, who was unceremoniously dropped from National Review and whose nomination to head the National Endowment of the Humanities was torpedoed by the neoconservatives, or Dr. Clyde Wilson, the world's greatest authority on John C. Calhoun. Now, whether hurled at us every night by Fox News like bile spewed from a broken drainage pipe, or screaming at us from the scurrilous pens of Victor Davis Hanson, Rich Lowry, or Brian Kilmeade, our new icons to whom we may pay homage are Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, and Frederick Douglass. I would argue strenuously that none of these personalities was a real conservative. Indeed, I would suggest that they were revolutionaries who assisted in corrupting our original Constitution. An older generation of conservatives, a Russell Kirk, a Stephen Tonser, Peter Stanlis, understood this. This is true. The problem is, we have a situation where the South cannot be championed anywhere because it's the antithesis of what Conservative Inc. wants you to believe is conservative. And that conservative is Abraham Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Frederick Douglass, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And when you point this out to them, they just call you names. The neoconservatives call you names. The Claremont people call you names. Gordon's essay, Memorial Day, shows up in the Federalist.com's daily assortment of essays where she is eager to present what she asserts is the correct interpretation of what battles like Antietam and Gettysburg were all about, what they mean. They seared into, this is her quote, quote, they seared into the nation's consciousness the immense human sacrifice her people were offering on the altars of union and universal freedom. Make no mistake, these Union soldiers died to make men free. And then, quoting from the ballad, The Battle Cry of Freedom, she ends with a flourish. The people of the Union in the 1860s knew well what Antietam stood for, to free the slaves. But that's not true. We know that the historical record does not show this. In fact, they were fighting to save the Union, not free slaves, and we know this. We know until 1863, there was really hardly, there were very few people that went off to fight the South that actually wanted to free slaves. We know even after that, there were mass desertions in the Union Army. That proposition is false and demonstrates Gordon's basic ignorance of both American history and Lincoln's enunciated war goals. From the very beginning of the war, he saw the conflict as a battle over the interpretation of the Constitution and states' rights. He stated this forthrightly to Horace Greeley of the New York Tribune on August 22, 1861, only a few months before the Emancipation Proclamation. Quote, if there be those who would not save the Union unless they could do the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in the struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some of them, leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union. As it was abundantly clear from the press of the period, a large majority of Northerners would not have supported a war to free the slaves. Lincoln knew that. The Emancipation Proclamation of January 1, 1863 only extended the states of the Confederacy not controlled by federal arms. Thus, where it was intended to apply, it could not free a single slave. But it did not apply to the several border slave states where it could have freed the slaves. It was, as Lincoln indirectly confirms, a propaganda measure intended to buoy up sagging support for the war both internationally and among more abolition-minded citizens. But more important, internationally. I mean, he doesn't say that, but this kept Britain out of the war. It kept Britain out of the war. The Queen, Victoria, was not going to support a pro-slavery government in her mind. And the South became pro-slavery and the North became anti-slavery, she would support the North. And of course, her husband, who died right about the beginning of the war, was certainly not, he was very much a reformist, was not going to support what he thought to be a crusading pro-slavery situation. In more recent times, especially the neoconservatives and followers of the academic Harry Jaffa latch onto Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, attempting essentially to amend by sleight of hand our understanding of the original Constitution and inserting a clause from the Declaration of Independence via Lincoln to the effect that 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth in this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. In other words, 1776 was the real founding of the United States, and that five little words define us, our history, and our goals as a people. It was a radical assertion greeted even at the time by many in the Northern press is a perversion of history so flagrant that the extended charity cannot regard it as otherwise than willful. It remains so today. Leslie Gordon apparently accepts this fraudulent view of history. Ironically, in so doing, she, like other neocons who assert equality as America's founding principle, places herself over with the progressivist version of the country. For they also maintain that egalitarianism is the American proposition. The difference being that while establishment conservatives like Gordon believe we have substantially achieved the desired equality uttered in poetic terms in 1776 by what is basically a propaganda document stating American grievances against King George, the progressive left sees equality as always an elusive goal, requiring continual government action to ensure what is called equity. The words recently written by David P. Goldman about such conservatism ring ever so true. Quote, their ideology is sort of a right-wing Marxism, with an origin philosophically in the not-so-distant past on the Trotskyite left, and a movement based on what is essentially the same foundation as the supposed opposition is hobbled and fatally flawed from the beginning. It will always succumb to the greater logic and conviction of its progressive enemies, who will always out-promise and out-argue its votaries. Such a movement has little room for defenders of a Lee or a Calhoun and those who rejected the idea of a proposition nation. Understood that the United States was not founded on an idea, but on the concrete reality of families who brought their traditions and beliefs with them to a new land, created a new country, and made it their own. And I'm going to add this, and fought for 5 miles. That's the point. You see, what Dr. Cathy is pointing out here is simply the reality of the situation. And that Americans were fighting in the South for 5 miles. They were fighting for the local. They're fighting for what they saw. And you know what? Even in the American War for Independence, that was the same. You look at what happened in the South during the war. The Carolinians were just fighting to get the British out. They weren't fighting for some lofty principles. In fact, they didn't care. You look at the Virginians fighting to get the British out, most of them. Now, some of them. There was this lofty nationalism and other things. Hamilton and Marshall and even Washington do away. But most New Englanders even were fighting just to get the British out of Massachusetts. They didn't care. That's why they wouldn't go fight anywhere else. And even in the war in 1861, you had a hard time getting people to go fight somewhere else. So this is the point. And this Lincolnian, I think Boyd Cathy does a fantastic job here of pointing out the real problem, the two sides of the same coin issue. If we could just hammer that home on a regular basis, and you have to keep saying it over and over again, and it gets a little exhausting to do it, but this is what we have to do, because that's the key to understanding everything. And then the last week piece of the week, just to wrap up here, a nice little review by Ronnie Kennedy of a book by Samuel Mitchum, who was one of our contributors, wrote an alternative history, the Retribution Conspiracy, The Rise of the Confederate Secret Service. What would happen, you know, the assassination of Lincoln? It's a different look at the Lincoln assassination plot. And it's, again, it's an alternate history, a fictional account. But I wanted to talk about it for a second because we have a link to it out there. And Dr. Mitchum is a great supporter of the Institute. He is someone who has done 2 Zoom webinars for us. We're gonna have more of those. 2 Zoom webinars for us, and they've been fantastic. So going out, I mean, we need to support people that are own people, and this book is certainly worth your support, and I think Ronnie Kennedy makes a good case for that. All right, so we had great stuff this week, as we always do. If you like the Institute, please consider a donation. We're going to start running some different donor campaigns to try to get you interested in supporting the Institute, but we do appreciate all the support you can give us. These articles that we put up here, they wouldn't be here if we didn't have revenue to do it. And so the revenue we get is when you open up your wallet. So again, we appreciate everything you do. We appreciate you taking the time to listen to this podcast once a week. We have 265 episodes. It's amazing. We've had that many episodes. We've been doing this now for, six years actually. I think 2015 is when we started. And so that's a long time to be doing this, and you've got a big catalog of material that we've done over this time, and all the good things I've said, the mistakes I've made, because I've made mistakes on this podcast, but I do appreciate you listening to it all the time and taking your time out of your week to do it. And I do it for you, so I do it for the Southern tradition. Until next time, good day.